You're listening to the Hybrid Cloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to hybrid cloud with your host, Andre Tost.
All right, welcome everyone, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Hybrid Cloud Podcast. Today's guest is J.R. Rao. JR is an IBM fellow and is also leading the security research for IBM. Thanks a lot for joining us today, JR.
Thank you very much, Andre, for inviting me.
So as always, we'll start out with introductions and learn a bit more about you, your background, your professional history, kind of how you got to be where you are today, and then maybe talk a bit about what it is that you do.
Thank you very much, Andre. Let me dive right in. So as you mentioned in the introduction, I am the CTO for security research at IBM. I have worked for IBM for 30 plus years. And in fact, IBM is the only employer that I have known. I came to this country and I got a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. And straight out of college, I joined IBM Research. Initially, this was in the early 90s, I was working in areas like, concurrent programming, distributed computing, using randomization probabilities for doing probabilistic parallel computations. And from there, I started working in building distributed middleware in a group in IBM. And this was a time in the early 90s when IBM was facing its own challenges. Company wasn't doing very well. We started moving more towards what our leadership at that time called market-driven quality, which is taking our inventions to practice. A term that was coined at that time was innovation. So we started working in areas like distributed debugging, for example, building distributed middleware, enable distributed programming. And then in the mid-90s, that led to the, that was the time when we saw this paradigm shift and the emergence of the internet. And it's around that time that I started working in security. And I've been working in that time ever since. It was a very good opportunity for me because I think if you look back at the last 25 to 30 years, these have also been the heyday of security. And I've had a ringside seat in terms of looking at how security needs to be infused into the industry platform as the platform has evolved from mainframes to the internet, to mainframe to PCs, to the web, to cloud, mobile, social, and now going forward into areas like AI and quantum. And every shift in this industry platform actually brings security challenges in its own right. Security, as you know, is always an arms race. And what happens is, it's always the attackers who are the first to take advantage of the shift in this industry platform. And it is the defenders who are trying to play catch up. And this is always the case because a lot of the technologies that we're talking about are democratized. AI, for example, is democratized today. The tools and techniques and libraries are publicly available for friend and foe alike to experiment with, and attackers are able to use those to launch devastating attacks, and then defenders have to play catch up. So, and I've really seen that unfold in the last 25 plus years, and I've had the privilege and the honor of contributing myself as well as leading and guiding teams to make contributions in these areas. So that's sort of a bird's eye view of what my journey has looked like. And then we can start diving into a little bit more about specific areas that I've worked in.
Okay. There are a couple of things you said that I want to poke on some more. So, first, I find it interesting that you say it's the heydays for security, right? It's kind of interesting how you know, security in itself is kind of, the need for security is a bad thing, right? We all would wish that we wouldn't need it, but we do, right? So it's something that we can't avoid, so to speak. What makes it probably different from other areas of research is, and you mentioned this, the fact that it's not, the evolution does not always happen in the open, right? There's obviously bad actors involved that are not necessarily willing to share what they learn and what they do. And so there's this constant notion of doing catch up. I wonder, how do you, I mean, or can you even try to predict what bad actors will do and then try to react to that before it's too late, so to speak?
Yeah. Again, there are many things you said, and let me try to unpack them one at a time. I mean, one can, and being a researcher, you probably have to be a little patient with me as I try to run through this for you. So there is a question of, you know, will there ever be a point in the future when there is no security? That's all security problems have been solved. And you know, in terms of the heyday of security. And, you know, I think I've reflected long and hard upon this, and it seems to me that as long as there is, you know, human in the loop, as long as there are actors who want to seek to get either competitive advantage or national security advantage, or, you know, just maybe, you know, or just make a quick buck, right? They were talking about the criminal element. As long as there's this human element in the loop, we're always going to have issues with security. Both from, you know, they will, such attackers will always find a way to subvert the system, and the system has to have mechanisms to guard against them, right? So that's point number one. The second point you talked about was, you know, do we foresee a point at which we can try to predict what such attackers would actually do? In fact, some of the work in the industry is going, I mean, there's this whole notion of shift left in many ways. So shift left is this whole discipline where you try to address problems upfront in building systems before you deploy them. And so that, because it's always harder to fix things that are out in the field, and it's much more easier to fix things when you're still designing and building them. And this shift left mentality also applies to things like if you look at the timeline of a security attack and how it unfolds, and you can see what in the security community is, of course, called the kill chain, for example, where an attacker gets a foothold in an organization, and many of these low and slow attacks, what's also called the advanced persistent threat, they do a fair bit of reconnaissance. And they're looking to expand laterally until they finally zero in on their target, and they either subvert the target and breach data and so on. So the whole idea of shift left in this kind of a world is about trying to intercept this kill chain earlier and earlier. And so there are many techniques which try to move left, which try to look at patterns of how attackers are moving within the enterprise, an area that I call threat kinetics, and even get even further left to see if you can find the point of initial infection. There are many controls deployed. So for example, a favorite technique that attackers use is to spearfish their targets by delivering email and luring victims to either click on those links or to open attachments. And of course, security education and awareness always helps. But, you know, there are tools that would scan emails for such malicious attachments so that you can try to flag incidents before they happen. Now, this is, again, this example I give you is one of, you know, which is fairly commonly known. It's this whole APT style attacks, cyber attacks follow this sort of a paradigm. But cyber attacks and APT attacks are not the only way that enterprises get subverted, right? So this is just one example. There are many other examples. Advances in technology, for example, a very good example here is, for example, quantum computing. And with quantum computing, we know, for example, that public key infrastructures, which rely upon hardness of certain mathematical problems like factoring, will no longer be hard when quantum computing becomes real. And what that means is the mechanisms that we are using for doing encryption, public key encryption, and digital signatures would be broken, but could be broken by attackers or actors who have access to quantum computers. This is fairly well documented. There are algorithms like Shor's algorithm, which will help, which show how you can factor, you can break the hardness of factoring. Now, how do you try to predict where attackers would go? In this case, it's just common sense. I mean, one has to start preparing for the eventuality, just as we did for Y2K, that quantum day, or Q day as we used to call it, or sometimes we call it YQK for quantum. So YQK is going to be here. And we have, and enterprises have to start planning to understand how and when to address the weaknesses that they have in the crypto systems that are currently deployed. And that includes taking a look at each and every place where cryptography is used in the IT infrastructures and enterprises. And the difficult part of this is cryptography is used everywhere. And the hard part here is that we don't really have an inventory. We haven't been very good at what's called crypto governance, at knowing where all cryptography is used, keeping track of which ciphers, which algorithms are used where, what are the key links, what are the certificates, so that we can very quickly swoop in and replace ciphers with or cryptographic algorithms with their quantum safe alternatives. So in many ways, we have our tasks cut out for us. And the only way to be ahead of attackers in this particular example, where attackers are taking advantage of quantum computing, is to prepare in advance and plan for this eventuality.
Yeah, so in that respect, that is actually a good example of something where we know what the future will bring, namely that once these computers exist, they will be able to be used to decrypt data that's encrypted, which is currently not possible. So I feel like that one is good insofar as we have time to prepare. And I guess we're saying, we IBM are saying that time is now. You cannot ignore this. You need to get on it in expectation of what is to come, right? So which is actually a benefit in that case, right? Because the computers are not ready, but we already know what they're going to be capable to do when that time comes. I had never heard that YQK abbreviation before. Is there a concrete year that we've plugged for this?
There are different estimates as to when quantum computing would become real. If you look in the literature, different academics, leading researchers in quantum computing have predicted anywhere from 3 to 5 to 7 years. IBM sometimes has called this a quantum decade, because we know within 10 years we're going to be there. But I would say that the most definitive source of where of trying to understand where this when this quantum becomes real is something that comes from the government. So the U.S. government has something it calls CNSA 2.0 guidance. This is the Commercial National Security Agency advice on what cryptography should be deployed and used by U.S. government agencies. And they have prescribed a timetable in terms of, that roughly starts around 2025. And depending on the level of the stack that one is, whether you're at a network router level, a operating system level, or a browser level, by 2020, somewhere starting from 2025 to 2027, is when U.S. government agencies should start preferring vendors who are offering products with quantum-safe ciphers. And by somewhere between 2030 to 2033 is when they should exclusively buy products that only have quantum safe cryptography. So traditional cryptography would be pretty much passé by then. So starting here now, so this is 2023. So I think that's a little bit consistent with what IBM is saying. Now, this is the US government, which has all sorts of sources of information. And, you know, in terms of, you know, how quantum progress is being made by different vendors in the realization of quantum computing. And so it's consistent with what IBM is saying that by 2033 at most, right, even earlier, perhaps, this will be real. And one thing to keep in mind is that rapid progress is definitely being made. IBM has published its roadmap. We plan to be over 1,000 qubits by the end of this year. We'll be releasing systems, and then there's a steady roadmap for the next several years beyond that. But spaces like this are governed by a law of exponentials. And what I've seen in the innovation space is innovation does not follow a linear timeline. And you never know what inventions were all combined together to give you that extra push that will really speed up the timetable by which you arrive at your end goals. So in this case, not only is progress being made in quantum computing, but progress is also being made in the number of qubits you need to be able to break hard problems like factoring. About a decade ago, it used to be 1 million qubits. Now, cryptanalysts have brought down the number of qubits required to break factoring to on the order of thousands of qubits. So both these are, again, pushing in the same direction. And that's something to keep in mind.
Okay. Let me go back and talk about a bit more of, you know, I don't know if that's the right word, but more traditional security topics. So, for example, a lot of attacks are based on the fact that I'm trying to run a piece of malicious code in a place, or that I'm trying to tap into a network to listen in on communication that is happening to extract information and to gain control. Are you doing any more research in those areas, as in, you know, next generation ransomware and malware, for example, or is that field pretty much exhausted?
No, actually, it's very good you asked this question, because that continues to be that avenue of attack continues to be a very vexing problem for defenders. And we're always constantly looking for invention and innovation that can help both what are called SOC analysts, security operations center analysts, as well as threat hunters in that space. That would give them advantage, a leg up and an advantage over the attackers. And you know, in recent years, the advances that have been made have been very interesting. So a lot of advances about a decade ago, we started the journey on working on what was called big data analytics. The whole idea that one needs to go beyond rule-based systems, which are easily circumvented. And really one has to start looking at ways of, rather than taking a myopic look at different point, different security controls, like a firewall, or a IPS, IDS device, or a application firewall, or a router, rather than take a myopic look, one has to bring observations across the board together to be able to then take a complete end-to-end view and get visibility of what's happening within the enterprise. And then determine from that how the thread of execution from an attacker is actually proceeding. So this was an area we worked in, I think 2009, 2010, called big data analytics, and we did a lot of work with the US government agencies. We actually put out a few press reports with the work on with the US Air Force and with the Federal Aviation Administration at that time. But in more recent years, that approach of work has actually generalized even further into areas around the use of AI, use of artificial intelligence. Now, AI means different things for different people, but things like continuous machine learning and big data analytics, which help you scour large amounts of data and find that proverbial needle in the haystack, is one capability that AI brings to help humans, whether they are SOC analysts or threat hunters. Now, there are other aspects of AI as well. There's a NLP, a natural language processing aspect to AI, which lets you consolidate a lot of threat intelligence, which comes from threat and vulnerability intelligence vendors outside, be it a Mandiant, be it IBM X-Force, or being any other entity that actually finds threat and vulnerability feeds. SOC analysts and threat hunters spend a lot of their time scouring this external sources of data to understand what attacks are underway, what are the indicators of compromise, what are the indicators of behavior. So AI holds the promise of being able to automatically parse and digest and consolidate and present a single stop, a single source where one can get access to such threat intelligence information. There's also an aspect of course, AI brings the aspect of automation. So if you think of the whole threat management lifecycle, where you have detect, investigate, respond, and analysts are spending a lot of time in each one of those phases, with automation, AI can really speed each of these up, so that, I mean, there are industry standards that we call out as 1-10-60, 1 minute to detect, 10 minutes to investigate, 60 minutes to respond. Now, we're not close to that, but we're getting within the ballpark, and AI is something that can help us there. And then finally, there are areas like human-computer interfaces, how you communicate with the machine in terms of conducting investigations. So this is like a symbiotic relationship, but where today our SOC analysts and threat hunters are tied to looking at screens full of alerts and trying to cope with them. Now, this kind of information can greatly be, an experience can greatly be improved by having tools that would actually automatically sift through the volume of alerts and do automatic triage based on perhaps the criticality of resources being targeted by those attacks that are underway, and also based on possibly past actions that analysts have taken to respond to similar incidents, and how one can consolidate that. And so that becomes automation. And then this could then drive or help with disposition of many different kinds of alerts. So now if you come to this domain of malware, of ransomware, that has consumed a lot of headlines in the last 2 years, especially because they bring businesses to a screeching halt and really hit the both the top line and bottom line in terms of causing financial loss to enterprises. It is only techniques like this, use of AI, right, and to speed up investigations and having better sources of telemetry, these are going to be very critical to being able to stand up against it. And this is a very fertile area of research. Now, there are other areas also which have emerged. So a lot of ransomware, for example, we know causes businesses to cease functioning because it encrypts a lot of the critical records that the business is using to operate. And so what we are also extending our research areas, and in fact, there are things, products now that we are putting out in this space, are things around how to protect storage even when you have ransomware attacks. So how to have, for example, it's a combination of both best practices as well as techniques for detecting ransomware attacks. As ransomware, for example, might be doing bulk encryption. So how do you detect bulk encryption and how do you stop some of these activities? So these are areas that we are continuing to work with. So in response to your question, yes, this is very much an area of research for us, Andre.
All right. Which makes me wonder, how do you develop and test solutions in this space? I mean, do you have an environment that's disconnected from the rest of the world so you can run simulations of attacks? Is that how that works? Or is it mostly, or I guess maybe another question is, where do you find data that you can use? You mentioned data analytics that's happening to detect attacks and so forth. In order to test a potential solution for this, you need to have data that simulates the situation you're trying to address, right? How does that work?
Great question. And, it's a two-part question. Let me try to answer it in two parts. So almost 12 years when we started this, it was very clear to me that our work cannot be done in vitro, that is in a test tube. We really have to work in vivo, which is with a functioning enterprise. At that time, IBM's enterprise networks had been outsourced, so they were being run by AT&T. And so we worked with our chief security officer at that time, so that when IBM redid its contracts with AT&T, we got access to a lot of the networking information, such as the firewall logs, DNS requests and responses, right? The Wi-Fi, the wireless authentication logs, single sign-on logs. So we got a lot of access to a lot of the information. And because we were so far ahead of the business, a lot of this information was information that was streamed into a very tightly controlled laboratory that we have here, where we would store that information and make it available to a very small team of researchers who had undergone a strict privacy course with our chief privacy officer to be able to access and use some of that data. We also took measures like anonymizing that data before use and so on. Now, that's the first part, right? So, and that really helped us because we could detect things we couldn't even imagine in terms of how attackers were trying to subvert the IBM company. Now, on the other hand, when you talk about ransomware, it's not just, it's not just the network traffic and logs and alerts you're talking about. You're actually talking about malware. And you're talking about how can you get malware, access to malware. Now, there are many sources of getting access to malware. That part is not hard, getting access to malware so that you can study it and you can experiment with it. The hard part is, where do you have the machines to put them? Because as you know, and as I know, all our machines are constantly being scanned by the IBM CISO. And if they find a piece of malware on your machine, they're going to just, they're going to shut it down. And you need to submit it back to them.
We actually had that problem in my team recently. We were trying to run some tests, and one of my team members' machine got cut off from the IBM network immediately because they detected a string in some of the, that was simply calling a REST API, and there was a string in there that was considered malicious, which led to exactly a discussion of how can we test our things without getting in trouble with our own CISO office and rules.
So the only way that we have found to do this is we have what's called a red lab that is disconnected from the IBM networks, but that is where we would, which has a live connection to the internet that bypasses firewalls, and which we use to bring in some of the malware and test and test it. That's the only way one can do it if one is trying to do malware research. So to have a sandbox to play in, because otherwise, given the threat, the potential threat that malware can pose to the IBM company or to any enterprise, it is very, very risky to have it on machines that are connected to the intranet. And that's something that, because things can go wrong, right? I mean, so that's something where we need to guard and take action. Yeah.
Tell me a bit about the kind of people that work with you in this space. I see every now and then I see educational sessions being offered to us that are titled Think Like a Hacker. It's basically saying put yourself in the place of the other guy so that you know what you can get an understanding of what they're going to be trying to do so that you can react to it, right? So how much is Think Like a Hacker, how much that does that influence the work you do and the kind of person that you're looking for in your team?
Right. A great question. So So IBM Security Research has about, I would say, 200 researchers who've spent their time thinking long, deep, and hard about security problems. And many of them have advanced degrees. Others have a lot of practical experience. And they have they have developed over a period of time a contrarian way of thinking. Let me explain what I mean by that. So typically, if one had to build a piece of software to solve a particular problem, then one does that in the straight and narrow way. One is focused on the problem, on the specification of the problem as an end goal, and one builds an application, be it a business application, or one builds a piece of middleware, be it a database service or a event, you know, messaging service or event complex event processing service. And one does that, and one designs it, does it, and sets it up. When one is designing such systems, one rarely thinks about how a malicious actor would try to subvert that system. That kind of thinking requires thinking in the complementary space, right? Because you have to, precisely by definition, if you're targeting a system, you have to think in a way that the designer of the system did not think. So if you're the designer of the system, you have, you know, it's not possible for you to meet that criteria. There's some kind of a Russell's paradox there.
And I can confirm that. I mean, I've been in IBM software development for many, many years, and that is not a focus area, right? People don't think about how could somebody maliciously break what I just designed and developed, because that's not, we think constructively, so to speak, not destructively, but that needs to be added to the equation.
That needs to be added to the equation. And sometimes I wonder whether it's even possible for both those ways of thinking to coexist at the same time. So maybe by inherently, you know, you can have specialists in each one of those that need to complement each other. But I do believe, so in terms of the kinds of people we are looking for, these are people who have actually hands-on interest and experience in terms of doing this kind of contrarian thinking, who have a way to adapt and find a way to go around. And over a period of time, so A, they have a capability to very rapidly prototype and set things up, whether to observe, to infiltrate, to scan, to probe. Also, over a period of time, they develop an instinct of where the weaknesses might be, because they think about how designers normally think and, oh, what are the areas where they might not have thought about. And, you know, and then at the end, and those are the kinds of skills they develop. But at the end of the day, we draw the line between white hats and black hats. We never hire a reformed hacker. So if we always believe that the work we are doing around security, security analysis, ethical hacking has to be held to the highest standards. So if somebody has ever been convicted in a court, it's very unlikely, almost impossible. And in my tenure, never would we hire such a person and bring him in. So, but we would look for people with those sorts of skills. And let me give you an example, because this might interest you. In the beginning of the pandemic, we had widespread use of video conferencing tools like WebEx and Zoom. And this now is public knowledge. But one of the things we were wondering was, the, you know, everybody was using Zoom, not just colleagues like yourself and myself for conducting business, but they were also being used for all sorts of meetings, even by the highest levels of people in the government, in the industry, for board meetings, where critical decisions were being taken. And so it occurred to us, would it be possible to join one of these web meetings without being detected? And we did a little bit of experimenting to understand how the protocols of, in this case, we were working with WebEx, how those protocols worked. And very quickly, we were able to realize and put in place a mechanism by which a person could join a WebEx meeting and listen to everything that was being discussed and view all the documents that were being presented without his or her name showing up in the list of participants, and without his or without their joining being noticed. Usually there's a beep when a participant joins. And this actually led, just to give you an idea how we work, once we found this, we demonstrated this to our leadership. We then reached out to the folks at Cisco, and we showed them how we were able to subvert the system. And in fact, we worked with them to reproduce. We shared our scripts, our harnesses, test harnesses with them so that they could reproduce the errors and they could fix their systems. And then finally, there were like three CVEs, three critical vulnerabilities that were Cisco filed and that were credited to folks in my team and myself. So this is an example of how one has to think and act, I think, and this is the important part, and act very ethically and responsibly in working together with the industry to raise the level of security for all of us. And those are the kinds of things we like to do.
I love that example. That's I did not know that. That's actually really cool. Okay, we're almost out of time here. And I say this, I think in every episode, I could keep talking for hours because I have so many more questions. But finally ask one more question. And that is, if you can give us an example of a project or an initiative that you're working on that you're involved in right now that gets you especially excited, something that makes you want to get to work in the morning, so to speak.
Oh, almost all the projects I work on have that flavor. One thing I think perhaps in the, you know, what's taken the world by storm currently is all the work around coming out of OpenAI with ChatGPT and what are called large language models, and what Microsoft is also announcing around things like Copilot. Now, I think almost certainly this technology is going to have a very disruptive effect in terms of its influence on society, in terms of industry and so on. What I'm very excited about is going back to your earlier questions about how this might help us change the odds with respect to the attackers, especially attackers who are using ransomware. So can large language models, or as we call them in IBM, foundation models, be used to greatly increase the level of defense for things like ransomware attacks and for threat management? And all phases of threat management, detection, investigation, and response. So that's an area that I'm working in. It's very exciting. There are other areas, of course. I mentioned along things like quantum computing. I haven't mentioned things like supply chain security, or for that matter, things like fully homomorphic encryption, another breakthrough invention that happened in the last decade. Definitely this is one that has my current attention.
All right. Very cool. Well, with that, like I said, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to thank you for spending time with us today. This was very, very insightful. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you very much, Andre. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to spend this time with you.
All right. So with that, we're going to wrap it up for today's episode. I want to thank you all for listening in and hope to see you all soon. Bye-bye.